In Lori Colwyn's novels and short stories, she tells us about her characters through the objects they surround themselves with: dishes, furnishings, clothing. In her new book, Home Cooking, Colwyn tells us something about herself through the food she loves to eat and prepare. Home Cooking is a collection of food essays and recipes. It's Colwyn's first nonfiction book.
I've always wanted to not write something that was fiction, but I don't know about anything. So the only thing I know anything about is cooking. So I decided maybe I would take a bash at it, and I wrote an essay called How to Fry Chicken. And it actually seemed to just fall out of the typewriter, and I loved doing it. So I did some more.
I want you to read something from the new book. How about the first couple of paragraphs from your introduction?
Unlike some people who love to go out, I love to stay home. This may be caused by laziness, anxiety, or xenophobia, and in the days when my friends were happily traveling to Bolivia and Nepal, I was ashamed to admit that what I liked best was hanging around the house. I am probably not much fun as a traveler either. My idea of a good time abroad is to visit someone's house and hang around poking into their cupboards if they will let me. One summer I spent some time in a farmhouse on the island of Menorca. This was my idea of bliss, a vacation at home, even if it wasn't my home. I would wake up in the morning, make the coffee, and wander outside to pick apricots for breakfast. I would wander around the markets figuring out the night's dinner. In foreign countries, I am drawn into grocery shops, supermarkets, and kitchen supply houses. I explain this by reminding my friends that, as I was taught in my introduction to anthropology, it is not just the great works of mankind that make a culture. It is the daily things like what people eat and how they serve it.
You strike me as someone who comes from a good food background, and by that I mean someone who didn't grow up eating Jell-O and tuna fish casseroles.
No, I did not. My mother is a wonderful cook. My sister is a wonderful cook. In fact, I come from a family of great eaters and very adventurous eaters, and I now realize that I say to my child the same things that were said to me. You don't have to like it, but you have to taste it, and if you don't like it, you can actually spit it out. And if you say that, you see, you can always get a kid to taste anything because of the idea that they could actually spit it out is very enticing. And as a result, my child eats a very wide variety of amazing things.
Now, is that good for you? Because that way you can cook it without your child complaining, I hate this, Mom.
No, that's not why I did it. I think it's nice to eat well. I mean, my child lives on, I mean, her lunchbox, I would say, is probably quite eccentric. I mean, she lives on 4-ounce containers of goat yogurt, which is made by this little company in Pine Plains, New York, and she really loves it. And she eats quail eggs and, I don't know. The point is, it's nice to eat well. She eats well. I don't have one of these kids who hasn't eaten a green thing in 5 years.
You make the observation in your new book that cooking for oneself reveals man at his weirdest. And I want to know if you know this from experience.
Oh, I do. Oh, yes. I mean, what I fed myself was pretty strange. But other people have... First of all, if you start thinking of people and food, for instance, the things people hate are very fascinating. And the converse of that is the things they love are very fascinating, too. For instance, I have a friend who is actually frightened of soft-boiled eggs, and another one who fears beets. And then there are people who won't eat all kinds of strange stuff. But when people are by themselves, no one's watching. They say they eat salads, but I don't believe this is true.
So what did you eat when you were living alone?
Well, I ate a lot of this peculiar kind of eggplant. I think I probably ate eggplant, if I was home 3 nights a week, I probably ate eggplant 3 nights a week. I just ate a tremendous amount of what I used to call eggplant sludge, which consisted of dark sesame oil, eggplants, hot peppers, scallions, and honey. It sounds disgusting. It's really delicious.
I think for some couples, the kitchen becomes a battleground because it's the place where you have to argue who's going to do the cooking, who's going to do the dishes, mm-hmm. What are you going to eat?
Yep.
Do you love food too much to let that happen?
I don't think that has to do with food. I think that has to do with a lot of other things. It has to do with territory, and it has to do with the sex roles that prevail in the United States of America, I think.
Oh, no, exactly. But it could end up ruining the food.
I don't actually think that is what happens. I think where you really get battles is when you have two people who have very different, highly developed senses of how to cook something. My husband, who says I only like cooking when it's dangerous, only knows how to cook one thing. Although if I were actually, you know, so sick I couldn't get up, I could get some poached eggs out of him, I think. But he makes the most wonderful pancakes in the entire world. They're sort of crepe-like. But most of the time, he will make a wonderful salad. He stays out of the kitchen, and we have a dishwasher.
For a while, you were preparing meals for homeless women at a shelter.
I was.
And you'd cook for about 120?
About, I would say between 98 and 110, I would say.
How did you start doing that?
Well, I worked for the Coalition for the Homeless, and it occurred to me one day that I actually was never in contact with any homeless people. And I went to pick up a friend of mine who was a caseworker at the Olivieri Center, and I said, I'll pick you up early, and I'll help serve lunch, and then we'll go out to lunch, and I never left.
What kind of dishes did you come up with that were easy to cook and were also inexpensive that you could prepare at the shelter?
Listen, everything was inexpensive and everything was easy to cook. I mean, when you're cooking for that number of people, you don't have too much margin for fooling around. The first time I cooked alone, there was a wonderful cook there, and I was there for a couple of months, and then I went on vacation, and then I was there for another couple of months, and one day I walked in, and there was no one in the kitchen. And I said to one of the maintenance guys, where's Jean? And he said, it's her day off. And I said, who's cooking? And he said, I guess you are. And I said, how many people am I cooking for? And he said, 98. And I thought, oh my God. I used to get nervous when I had a dinner party for six people. So I made my mother's old-fashioned baked spaghetti, and it was a big hit. So that was one of my staples. I made stew. I made chili. I made lentil soup. I made borscht, which was a really big hit. I tried to cook a lot of vegetarian meals because they got a lot of meat because they just did. And I remember one lady came up to me and she said, you know, when you're making coleslaw, could you please remember that some of us don't have any teeth? So those are the sort of things that you have to remember when you're cooking for that. That specific population was the chronically homeless, mentally ill, or what I guess people call bag ladies.
I'm sure there's some shelters in which the important thing is to just get out the food, but not much care is paid to how the food tastes.
I actually don't think that's true.
Really?
Except, well, in the public shelters, that's probably true, because when I used to monitor in the public shelters, there was a lot of, you know, when you talk to the ladies about how they were being fed, there was never enough. And I remember somebody had written on the wall, murder, burgers, and suicide meat. I mean, the food was obviously disgusting, but in the private shelters, it's another thing. And when I was cooking at Olivieri, the word came out that the food at the Holy Apostles Soup Kitchen was really great, and I was so jealous. I was really, I thought, I got to go over there and see who's cooking over at Holy Apostles, and I have to find out what they're giving, because they have, apparently, they still have wonderful food.
Let's talk a little bit about your fiction. You write novels and short stories. Do you think of yourself as using food to reveal character in your fiction?
I wouldn't say that I rely on it very heavily, but, I mean, those things are details, and all details are evocative. I mean, I think it's as evocative as the sort of things people wear.
When you're writing, do you ever write in the kitchen?
Never.
Why not?
Why would I do that? My typewriter won't fit. No, I'm very disciplined about that. I have a, you know, I used to have a desk. It's been commandeered by my child, who's taken all my typewriter paper. I have no pencils. She took all my pencils. But most of the time, I just sit down at my desk and work, although when I moved into the apartment of a normal person as opposed to a cracker box, I was very flummoxed in the beginning because in my old apartment, since it was one tiny room about the size of this tiny studio I'm sitting in, I could sit and work and see that the water was boiling on the stove. Now I can't do that anymore because the kitchen is an actual separate room.
Okay, well, Laurie Colwin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Laurie Colwin's new book, Home Cooking, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air.